You box.
Thank you.
Five, six, yeah, we do, when you're ready. Okay, all right. House Committee on Revenue will come to order. I will note that it's 1:13 in the afternoon. I apologize for the late start, but apparently we've had some communications problems with the Department of Revenue. And it's in somebody's email server, but we don't know whose yet. So the result is that we're now working on, with paper copies, and I'll apologize to our internet audience that some of the meeting materials for today's meeting may not be up until late because of the need to for that transmission to be completed. I think what we're going to do is try to hold the income tax administration information meeting toward the end of the meeting in hopes that either our communications problem will fix itself or that we'll have some paper copies. And in the meantime, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2488. Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2488 is a bill that the Department of Revenue has proposed, and basically it would change. There is currently a penalty for understating taxable income on the income tax return, and it's in the amount of 20% of the tax difference that's due to that understatement. There are a couple of problems potentially with this definition or defining the penalty this way, including the it could be unclear what is considered taxable income, whether it could be if a person potentially could list their federal taxable income accurately but understate their state taxable income and still not incur this penalty. Also potentially they so this change would actually create a penalty for an understatement of net tax, and that's further down on the form, and there's a little bit less ambiguity as a definition of what net tax is. Also, that would cover people who had either fraudulently or accidentally misrepresented their credits. So it's further down the page on the tax form and encompasses more potential of pitfalls that the current definitions might leave open. But Deanna Mack is here today from the Department of Revenue to discuss some of the reasons for this change.
Great.
Members of the committee, thank you for your indulgence this afternoon. Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue, and I'm here to talk about our legislative concept that is in House Bill 2488. And much of what Christine said is exactly what we're hoping to fix. Right now, we have a 20% penalty for the understatement, the substantial understatement of income and taxable income. And the IRS and other states all go to look at net tax. And because of that, there's some conditions inside of the imposition of that penalty related to, what's the terminology, adequate disclosure and substantial authority for the understatement. And because of the differences between taxable income and net tax and the interpretations between federal and state law, we would like to just go to the same definition as federal law, which would be to tie to net tax. In doing so, Christine mentioned that it does bring the number down on the return. If you're familiar with the Form 40 or the other information, it does come after credits, before payments. So it would also pick up people who do substantially understate their tax because of an overstatement of a tax credit that they were not entitled to. Now, that said, this law was brought into place in 1987, and a substantial understatement of income back then was $15,000. That's what the legislature considered to be substantial. Of course, the minimum wage was $3.35. It's now $9.25. So we would like to ask you if you still believe that $15,000 is substantial, And that equates to, I think, about $1,000 of tax, if that would be the number that you would like to continue with. And if you do change the number, we would like you, if it's in your pleasure, to index that number every year so that we continue to have what you consider to be substantial. So that is the concept in a nutshell. If you have any questions, happy to answer them.
Well, let me start. What numbers would you suggest inserting in those blanks? What would the department suggest inserting in those blanks? And I understand you'd like to, whatever those numbers are, that we index them in some way.
Right. The Mr. Chair, the average taxpayer, I think, in our research reports pays somewhere around $4,700 in tax. So if you want to consider some ratio of that, we're open to whatever you consider to be substantial. We're not sure that $15,000 is still substantial, but we're open to work with you on whatever you consider to be a reasonable number.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Can I ask what version of average that is? Is that median? Is it mean?
Mr. Chair,
not to be too picky, but right. Just
Representative Smith Warner, I'd have to look at the publications. They're on our website. I believe it's effective tax, the average effective tax rate, and that's what the 4,700 is that okay. Number, I believe. I can double check that though. Thanks.
That's a great question because, of course, if that's the average, then the median number is much smaller.
Yeah.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so I understand, in the very first line. We follow the IRS penalty almost verbatim. Oregon's penalty based on understatement of taxable income instead of understatement of net tax. Which does the federal government do?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, the federal government relies on net tax. They have their substantial understatement of net tax, and we do taxable income. We would like to move to what they do.
Go ahead. I know you're about to ask the next question. Yeah.
Well, to follow, Mr. Chair, what I was trying to do, I just wanted to make sure because the sentence wasn't, it does say it later, that that's exactly what you're doing. And the IRS is, do they have a definition of the number we're struggling for? Maybe you said it here and I just haven't picked it up.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bence, they do have some case law and some guidance around what is considered substantial authority and adequate disclosure of an item that's supposed to be on the return. So there's some the way it should be reported. So we follow that guidance in their regulations and in court cases. And the difference between the net tax and the taxable income is what causes some ambiguity for us to decide whether we should follow their guidance exactly or not.
Please, yeah. So what I'm trying to get at is, have they established a number as you are now asking that we provide you, or are they just giving us general guidance? I'm just trying to figure out when you would owe a penalty to the federal government. Is it going to be the same as what we're suggesting?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, let me double check on that number. I'm not exactly sure what that federal number is. I think it's $5,000, but I'll double check on that.
Mm-hmm. And a final question.
Yes, please.
How often does this come up?
We, Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, we issue, I did ask them to provide this information, about of the deficiencies that we do issue, about 15% of them do have, are eligible for this penalty under current law. So we issue about, in 2000, as of November, the end of the year last year, we issued about 20,000 deficiencies, and of that, about 3,100 of them had the substantial understatement of income penalty assessed against it.
I'm sorry, I was busy reading again. How much is the penalty?
The penalty, Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, the penalty is 20% of the net tax that was,
that was understated.
The tax that was understated, yeah. But it's based on an understatement of taxable income.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead.
Is that okay?
That's fine.
Representative Davis?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for your testimony, Deanna. It strikes me that it's difficult to consider this bill in a vacuum without an example or a few examples of net tax versus taxable income. So perhaps maybe by email or in the next time we hear the bill, we could have a couple examples. I know that's very dependent on what number we choose, mm-hmm. or might choose, and thank you for the department's deference to this august body to select that number. But perhaps leaving 15,000 in there, we could have a couple examples of how it would be affected.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, we can get you that specifically. I can give you an example of a tax credit that we see on returns. It's a credit for taxes paid to another state, and that can be a fairly substantial credit. And if they claim that credit and they were not entitled to do that and they did that improperly without a reasonable basis or adequate under the federal law, right now there's no consequence for them to try doing that. So they would have a net tax understatement. Their taxable income would be just right, but their understatement would be because of the credit that was claimed on the return. And then when we restore it, there's no penalty for substantially understating their net tax. They just got their wrists slapped, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting follow-up?
Yes, please.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
You so now understand why they wrote the bill, don't you?
Yeah, so it can work both ways in a sense. I mean, in this instance, it's detrimental to the taxpayer who may be trying this method. And in other instances, I would seem to me that using net tax as opposed to taxable income could substantially reduce or limit the number of instances where a penalty could be imposed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, that is correct. We believe that there would be, especially if you index the number, raise it at all, we believe there would be fewer penalties assessed.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
So you go after the guy who is trying a fast one, and you stop going after people who simply made an error that doesn't result in this larger net tax error.
Correct.
Right. Thank you, Representative Bentz.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And of course, you catch them. They still owe the tax, and they probably owe interest on the tax if it's been understated. So we're merely debating the application of the penalty.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, that is correct. This does not change any of the other provisions, interest provisions specifically.
Okay, correct. Thank you.
And you've taken care of this adjustment in the black language after line 17. The inflator that you wanted.
Correct.
Now, that's I just want to make certain I understand. The number that is in section 13, or line 13 now, the $15,000, that refers to taxable income, doesn't it?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
So if we were to do a comparable number that was connected to net tax, we would have to figure out what the net tax comparable number is and insert that number instead.
Right, and I believe that right now is about $1,000 around
okay.
that, plus or minus, Mr. Chair.
All right. So now that I've finished reading the black letter on this bill, to accomplish what the department actually has asked for, what we need to do is insert those numbers in line 13 and line 16, because you've already dealt with the other issues that you raised in the bill.
Correct. Mr. Chair, one more thing I might add is that is for the personal income tax program.
Yes.
The corporate tax program has a $25,000 taxable income understatement, which is a lower, $3,500 of tax. And we also ask that you evaluate whether that is considered substantial given the corporate tax.
Do we have a bill for that?
It is this bill.
Oh, it's this
it
bill.
It is lines 14 through 16 of this bill.
Okay, so that's where the second blank is.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Right. All right, any other questions? It would be very helpful to us to have some more information on what you think that blank, those two blanks should be filled with and why.
Yeah.
And we might do that with a document rather than another hearing, but that would be, and part of it depends on the public interest, I think. I mean, interested people who might want to testify. Anything else? Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 2488? And if not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2488. And while we have a substantial quorum here, I'm going to open a work session on possible introduction of committee bills. Representative Vance.
Mr. Chair, I move LC 3178, LC 3222, LC 3264, LC 3268, LC 3442, and LC 3524 be introduced as committee bills.
Thank you. Vice Chair Benz moves LC 3178, 3222, 3264, 3268, 3442, and 3524 be introduced as committee bills. The usual proviso applies. The vote for this motion, a motion like this, does not imply that members like or dislike these bills or would vote for them to be referred to the floor. It's simply a way of getting the bills before the House for consideration. That having been said, is there a discussion on the motion?
I just have a question.
Representative Whitsitt.
Why do we do LCs instead of bills?
Well, bill numbers are not assigned until the LC draft reaches the clerk's desk.
Right.
The clerk assigns the numbers, and that doesn't happen until after they're introduced. The purpose of this motion is to do that introduction.
Okay. All right. I just wanted to make sure why they weren't.
Yeah. So the document number we have is the LC draft number.
Because it's a committee bill then. So.
Right.
Okay.
It becomes, yes. And later on when you see the first reading report,
right,
it will say introduced by the Committee on Revenue.
I just was clarifying it's committee bills is the
right
reason that we do that. So.
It's a little complicated.
Yeah.
It okay, definitely is.
Yeah, thanks.
Any other discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, that motion it is so ordered. Bills will be introduced. We'll close the work session on introduction of committee bills and open a public hearing on House Bill 2489. Kyle.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2489 is relating to administration of increases of cigarette taxes. And what the measure will do is it removes the expiration of cigarette tax stamps following the two scheduled increases under current law in January of 2016 and January 2018. And it would also limit the distributor purchases of cigarette tax stamps in the 2 months prior to each of the scheduled tax increases. So that'd be in November and December of 2015 and 2017. And the limit on the purchase of the tax stamps is 150% of the 6 month average for each distributor. So that'd be the time period of May 1st through October 31st. And that 6 month average is to be calculated by the Department of Revenue. So they will use their information to calculate that. So that's what the measure does. And I wanted to give probably a little background as well to provide some context on why we have this measure. But the originally House Bill 3601 during the 2013 first special session. This is widely referred to as the grand bargain. But there were three scheduled tax increases included in that piece of legislation. The first was a 13-cent increase that became effective January 1st, 2014. At 13 cents, I should mention, this is per pack of 20 cigarettes, which is kind of the most standard size pack. And then there's the two other increases that are scheduled in January 1, 2016 and January 1, 2018 are each of 1 cent per pack. And included in that legislation was a floor tax on the cigarette tax stamps for the 13-cent increase. And what a floor tax does, it's a pretty common thing done, not just in Oregon, but in many states. The idea being you tax the existing inventory of the tax stamps at the time of the new tax increase. And the idea is that you would avoid the purchase of tax stamps under the old lower tax amount and kind of load up on that and buy them at a lower value, and then you could sell them at the higher amount. So it avoids, I guess, being able to game the system a bit, taking advantage of the tax increase. So the larger the tax increase, the more chance there is for a distributor, I guess, to make money on that tax increase if they were to purchase more stamps ahead of time. So the floor tax is just the tax takes place right when the tax increase goes into effect, and it kind of eliminates that problem. Now, in the language in House Bill 3601, rather than have a floor tax on the 2 1-cent increases, there was this expiration of the tax stamps scheduled to expire on January 31. And so what that will do is it means as of January 31, on February 1st, anything that a retailer or a distributor is in possession of will become contraband, and it can be subject to seizure. So they're not allowed to sell it, and there's even civil penalties that could go along with that. So it would essentially require distributors and retailers to work through their existing inventory in that 1 month period more or less. Because if anything they have left over with the old stamps, they're going to be unable to sell. And that could be problematic, I suppose. So that's where we are right now. And I think that's kind of the reasoning behind why this bill is brought to us by Department of Revenue.
Thank you. In other contexts, we'd call that arbitrage. Yeah. Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Deanna Mack. I'm here to testify on our concept that is captured in House Bill 2489. And we, Kyle did an excellent job of explaining why exactly we're bringing this bill. Considering having the product expire, the stamp expire, causes retailers and distributors who have this product on hand not only the cost of the one penny stamp increase, but also the rest of the Oregon tax, the federal tax, and the cost of their product. And so we thought that might be a fairness issue you'd want to consider, given it's a 1 cent increase. Additionally, the reason why we went with, there were some other options we considered for, you know, doing a floor tax, doing some other options, and we chose to manage sales because we felt that that was the best way to respect your intent of not having these people have to do a floor tax because of the burden of the taking inventory on New Year's Eve, also. It was just one penny. Now, to give you some context about the risk of front loading, a roll of stamps cost $39,000, somewhere around that market. And this 1 cent increase is the result. It would be $300 of tax savings if they did front load. We don't think that people are going to incur that kind of a cost to do that. However, there is that risk. So we would ask that you allow us to manage the sales rather than have the expiry for those two tax increases. We are open to the window that you look at, the sales window, and we're also when we can restrict sales as well as the amount that they're restricted to. I know right now the bill says 150%. We're open to whatever would create a revenue neutral bill. We're also open to moving the May through, it could be a 1 year period instead of a 6 month period. All of those things are, but the concept that we landed on is what is presented in this bill right now.
Thank you. Questions, comments? I have one. Have the distributors and retailers weighed in on this? Do they think this is a practical approach?
Mr. Chair, that's a great question, and I did mean to include that. It is in my testimony. We did get feedback from several people, and the original feedback was, sure, that's great. And then after we got to a certain point of kind of no return with the concept development process, we got information from them that they actually do not like the management of the sale, but would prefer you to have a de minimis amount opposed with a floor tax. That would be the general preference, where you actually do go ahead and do a floor tax, but you have some minimum amount of filing before they're required to file a return. Presumably that would be at our cost to to administer a floor tax. For the 13 cent increase last year, we had 3,400 retailer returns for just that 13 cent increase. And I want to say I can't remember exactly what our administrative costs were, but they were less than $50,000 to administer that floor tax. Of course, it includes a return processing the returns, creating forms and instructions, and getting that out there. It does have a burden that would shift to larger distributors and retailers as opposed to everyone across the board. So that would be something you'd want to consider, and why we haven't actually changed our concept yet. But that is something that we're willing to entertain if you're considering that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I find this really confusing, but yeah. can you go down to your fourth paragraph where it says the potential solution to manage sales? What's that mean, to manage sales? I could guess at it, but I'd like it rather be told.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, we would, instead of just allowing the retailer to purchase as many stamps as they want, we would limit the amount of stamps that they could purchase. So we would manage the amount that they're allowed to buy to prevent front loading, so they wouldn't be able to buy the $39,000 roll of stamps to save themselves $300.
Thank you.
Please, yep.
And so why don't you want to do that? Why don't you just tell us that's what you're going to do? Explain that again, if you would.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, that is what the concept is asking for. Right now, the stamps are scheduled to expire, and we need to have that removed from the statutes. Otherwise, the product that is on the floors and in their shelves would become contraband. We would seize it. If we discover it, we would seize it. We would have to the destruction costs of the product, and they would lose all of their underlying costs associated with that pack. Does that answer your question?
If I may.
Please, yeah.
It says the potential solution. Do you mean the suggested solution? Is that what your fourth paragraph means?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vince, yes, that's a typo. It is a suggested solution. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Vega Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. So I just, could you go into a little bit more why the floor tax was not considered as an option with the increases that we had in the special session?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vega Peterson, I do recall being here quite late those nights, and I know that there was some conversation between LRO and LC and our agency and me about what to do about the cost associated with imposing a floor tax, because our administrative costs for not only us but also for taxpayers would eat up the revenue from the tax very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. And so they threw some ideas out, and we didn't really have time to vet them, and that was what they landed on. We could have done more than 1 month. Mm-hmm. It could have been a six-month expiration, but they ended up landing on the one-month number, and that's how we got where we are. We had then time afterwards to actually think about how is this really going to work. We started hearing from some distributors that, you know, gosh, we're really not a fan of this expiration component.
Yeah.
And they don't really have a advocacy group, so that's why, as part of our duty to bring to you inequities and things like that, we're bringing this concept as well.
Okay. Paula? Mm-hmm. Thank you for that explanation. I think we all remember the special session. So some of the retailers who did respond with feedback would prefer the floor tax with a de minimis amount. However, we still run into the problems of the administrative costs in doing that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vega Peterson, that's exactly correct. We still have the administrative costs to administer the floor tax.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you again for your testimony. The proposed solution, just looking at lines 14 through 18 of the bill, is the department saying that this solution would be more efficient? Because it seems to me like it's still a fair amount of work. The DOR shall determine for every licensed distributor the average number of cigarette tax stamps purchased in that period between May 1st and October 31st. Presumably, this is not something the department has done previously, or have you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, we actually do track this data, and we do have it readily available for us. And I know it's not something that's difficult. We have, I think, 40-some-odd licensed distributors.
Okay.
It's a really small population of people that we're dealing with that mm-hmm. actually purchases and control and deals with us with the stamps. So it's not a huge workload for us.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I wouldn't want to prejudge this at all, but there are bills that are in this committee that would significantly raise the tobacco tax. I'm assuming that if one of those bills were to pass, we'd want to make certain that we dealt with this issue in that bill.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. We would appreciate that, yes.
Okay, all right. Thank you. Any other questions for her? Is there anyone else who would like to speak on House Bill 2489? This may be your only chance to do that. I don't see anyone. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2489. Are we ready, Paul, to do the information meeting? We are. Okay. So we'll open the information meeting on income tax administration. We'll let him pass around his materials. And I'm assuming that when we get our glitch fixed, we'll post this material in OLIS for today. Is it Paul? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we will. Okay, Kyle tells me we will. So those of you who are very large audience on the internet, we'll have access to this material too, but not just yet.
Right.
Thank you. And I'm hearing chuckles from the committee, but you might be surprised.
Do they know? Is there a way to know?
What's that?
Who's watching? How many people are
watching? That's a very good question. We should ask it to see if they're keeping track. Is someone introducing this, or do I go directly to the department?
That's a bad idea. While we're waiting, can I share my experience from
yes,
of watching this committee?
Yes.
Yesterday.
Oh yes, you had another thing to do in Portland, and so you were a little late. Yes. So.
I was.
But you had
gainfully employed in the morning in my Portland office, yes, and had to leave a little bit later than I anticipated, and was able to pull up the hearing and listen to the entire informational hearing on I-5 in my car wow, on the way down. So I just felt very techie yesterday. It was great.
Yes, and you were successful in navigating your car safely into the parking garage. That's good to know.
Sometimes that's a challenge.
Christine, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the presentation today is about the income tax administration in Oregon. And once again, Deanna Mack is here to go through a PowerPoint has just arrived. And she'll be covering some of the major high points of income tax administration.
Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Deanna Mack is your Department of Revenue. And I'm here today to talk about an overview for you of our income tax administration. I believe John Phillips was here already talking about our property tax system, and I understand that Eric Smith will be here next week to talk about our core system replacement update, so I won't go into any of those details. We'll just focus on income tax administration. And I apologize for not having the technical issues with getting that document over here this morning. But the major programs that we administer that I'm responsible for as a resource to you are the income taxes, the personal and corporate income taxes, and also our cigarette tax program. We value being highly objective on this process and to give you as much information as we possibly can so that you can make informed decisions. We work very closely with the Legislative Revenue Office and your staff there, and I would encourage you to continue to use me and in partnership with them as we can to help you with your bills if you need information. We have the income tax program. We have basically the three areas are education, assistance, and enforcement. That's where we spend quite a bit of our resources, and it is alongside of the voluntary compliance component, and I'm going to go into that on your slide three. The Department of Revenue is responsible for administering most of the money that comes into your general fund. Our first largest program is the personal income tax program, and it brings in about $13.7 billion biennium into your general fund. The second largest program that we administer that I have responsibility for here is our corporate income tax program, and it brings in just about $1.6 billion a biennium, so it's a little bit more than it has been. And then our third largest program is our tobacco tax program, and it brings in about $500 million or so, but only 132 of that goes to the general fund. The rest of it is dedicated to other services we'll talk about later. Also on the slide here, you'll see there's a little green sliver there for our estate tax program, which brings in about $189 million a year. And then we collect some other taxes and criminal fines and assessments, our amusement device tax program, and those are in the other category. On your slide four, I've got a nice little graphic produced by our brilliant communication section that talks about the work that we do in what we call cradle to grave programs. This is where we actually, as an agency, have administrative oversight for the program from start to finish. So we start with education and assistance, and we have an obligation to help taxpayers understand what their obligations are and to what tools they have that are available to them to make it easier for them to comply. Assistance in education takes many forms. We have forms and instructions that we develop, publications. You might have seen some of them if you're the payroll tax booklet, we do that annually. The form, personal income tax forms instructions, form 40 every year, and several other, hundreds of other booklets. We also have our website where we have tools for people to use. We value self-sufficiency, and so we're working towards that and developing applications for taxpayer self-sufficiency. One example is our W-2 and 1099 filing system called iWire. Another one is recently put in place because of our court system, and we call it Revenue Online. Taxpayers can go on to our website and get a lot of information on their own by just logging in. We also have a call center where we have several dozen people that handle taxpayer calls during, especially during the filing season, but all year round. And then we also have an automated calling system. It's an IVR where people can call in and get answers to most frequently asked questions. And then, of course, we have the main building across the street, down the street, where people can come in, and we have field offices sprinkled around the state where people around the state can come in and get help from us in person. The next section is the processing of the returns when it comes in. We, for the personal income tax program, we expect to process about 1.9 million tax returns this year, especially in the next few months. To give you a little bit of perspective, as of yesterday, we processed about 183 returns so far. This year, last year at this time, we had about 170,000. The last couple of years, we've had some delays in our return processing because the IRS or the federal government has not decided very timely about some extender provisions, and so the IRS doesn't start processing returns until the end of January. Of course, that's when we start as well. But we also process amended and past due returns in addition to all of the current returns that we are currently handling for the current tax year, which is 2014. Last biennium, we passed the 80% filing mark for electronic filing. This year, we expect to reach 83%. So 83% of those 1.9 million returns would be filed electronically. About 10% of them would be filed with a 2D barcode software. If anybody uses software to prepare a return and they print it and don't email it to us, it prints a barcode on there. And that barcode contains all the information from the return. And it looks like snow on your television set or on the back of your driver's license. There's that little snowy that's what the 2D barcode has. It has all the information. People literally can just scan a wand and the information's in our system, so it's very efficient. Only about 10% of the returns are using those, but that leaves us with about 7% of returns actually being filed using paper. So it's become a very efficient process. Our processing of returns also, beyond just getting the information into our systems, also we verify that the taxpayer's information is correct before we release the refund or we issue the taxpayers or bill the taxpayer. So for information that's on its face, this is not an audit. It's just we're looking at the return. There's math errors. There's maybe a limitation on, for example, federal tax subtraction is one area where you have imposed a limit, and so it's very easy if someone goes over that limit to just make an adjustment to that and make sure it complies at least with that. So we'll do those kinds of things in our processing center to make sure that returns are accurate. Last year, this area, we call this area our suspense department because return does get manually, it has to be looked at by someone. That area of the department made about $27 million in net adjustments. So it's a very critical area of the department. What that means is that they actually issued about $55 million in deficiencies. So if someone was short on their tax, they made some sort of a facial error that resulted in more tax. We also corrected about 28 refund returns in the amount of about $28 million. So we increased refunds by that amount. So the gross adjustments from that unit alone was $84 million. So the tax, the net tax is $27 million after all that's said and done in additional billing from that department.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Smith.
You said that they focus on that division focuses on the paper return. So you're saying all of that adjustment just comes out of the paper returns?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith-Warner, that is not correct. It's all returns.
Okay.
It's just they have to have somebody, a set of eyeballs, actually look at it to make sure that they're correct.
But those adjustments are from
mismatch so all three ways that those returns can get to that unit get there, and they look at them that way.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's under the resolve errors and issue bills section. I will note that our crack computer wizards have gotten this material up on the meeting materials site. You may want to refresh your browser. I will simply note that the material as it comes up, it comes up sideways. So if you go to the caret, the double caret at the end of the line on that thing, push on it once. You can rotate it clockwise, and you'll have it looking correct. And I've done that, and so I know it works. And I appreciate whoever's figured out how to actually get it up there.
And you say you're not a computer whiz.
Except maybe it won't work now for the big screen. Anyway, thank you. Why don't you go ahead?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the next area of our income tax return or area is our banking area. And primarily, we bank money. It comes from two primary sources. One is electronic means, which is electronic funds transfer, ACH, debit card, credit card, those kinds of transactions, and also paper. So money orders, cash, and checks. Those are the two primary sources where money comes through to the department. About three quarters of the payments that come in through electronic are come in electronically. Of the payments that we receive, about 25% of them come in via the old-fashioned way, paper and checks. The electronic transfers that come into us, about $5 billion of that is from employer withholding, and that is where the tax is collected at the source of payment through wages. So it's the amount that's reduced from your employee's wage and remitted to the department periodically, daily, depending on the size of the employer, monthly, and the return is filed quarterly. So that is received throughout the year, and it is about $5 billion a year. Our enforcement functions are auditing and filing enforcement. And in our auditing function, as you know, we work with the taxpayer to verify the accuracy of the return, make sure that they've got the substantiation that they need to qualify for the credit. And that can take some time to work with the taxpayer. But we're working to, you know, verify the accuracy of their filing. In our filing enforcement function, we have a fairly fleshed out staff of people that work on getting people who are not in our system currently, not filing returns, to file returns. So we work with them to get them into compliance. The collection function, there are three primary ways in which we get money that needs to be collected. Debt that a taxpayer assesses against themselves when they file the return and they don't pay in full. Audit adjustments, and then filing when we set up someone for filing enforcement. If they don't actually file a return, we have the ability to set up an assessment against them based on the information we do have available to us, which is often information from employers. It could be self-employment information as well. But all of that works out to be about, on your side, you'll see $14.8 billion, which represents about 94% of your general fund. So we take our job very seriously. On your slide five, the personal income tax revenues, this illustrates a very important part of our work. As you can see, the vast majority of revenues comes in from voluntary compliance. So the education and enforcement component of our work is extremely important. About $5 billion, again, I mentioned earlier, about $5 billion comes in from payroll withholding. And there is another sizable chunk that comes in through quarterly estimated tax payments, where this is people who are maybe self-employed, maybe have some retirement income that isn't subject to withholding or interest and dividends that they need to pay taxes on. They don't want to have to end up owing at the end of the year, so you've required them to pay throughout the year as well. And then the rest of them comes in, a lot of it, with the payment with the tax return. The tax return at the end in April is actually a reconciliation of all those payments that were made throughout the year. And if there is less due, less paid, excuse me, than is due, then they'll send a check with that amount. So as you see, 97% comes in from voluntary compliance, and 3% comes in from our audit and collections or audit and compliance efforts. And that has raised in the last couple of biennium, I think it used to be about 2%.
Chair Barnhart.
What's the process you go through to try and collect that 3% Is it audit driven, or do you send a letter first and then threaten with an audit and then go through with an audit? Or I was just wondering.
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, we actually have that 3% represents all of the enforcement functions that I mentioned, the audit function, the filing enforcement, and then also the collections function. So each of those three have different requirements. The audit function, typically we send a come-in letter to mm-hmm. a taxpayer, say, look, we think there's something wrong with your return. Please call us. Let's schedule an appointment. And we work with them over a series of months before we land on a place where we may issue a deficiency. We may issue a no-change audit because we've determined that they've done it correctly, or we may issue a refund if we determine they've done it incorrectly. Filing enforcement, we send a notice of say, hey, look, we think you should have filed a return based on our records. Please get in touch with us. Send us a return. If they don't comply with that or contact us, and about 40 days later, we send another notice that says, look, we really think you need to file a return. Please do it. And often it'll have a temporary like a proposed assessment amount if they're wage earners or self-employed. And then after that, another 40 days or so later, then we send a failure to file assessment, which is a bill. And from those points, including the self-assessment, so each of those points are what we call an assessment. There's a deficiency is issued. They have 30 days to appeal it, and then it becomes assessed. From each of those three assessment points, deficiency assessment, failure to file assessment, or what we call a self-assessment, then it goes into our collections function. We send a letter to to the taxpayer that says, we believe you owe us, you have this debt. 30 days later, we send another, what we call a notice and demand for payment. We ask them to contact us to set up a payment plan. They're entitled to one under the Taxpayer Bill of Rights. And then we, after that, then we get into, if they still don't contact us, then we get into more advanced collections where we issue a what's called a warrant, and it's recorded often in the county records if there's property, real property. And then we can go into more advanced collections like garnishment, seizure, that kind of things. But we really spend a lot of time trying to get with the taxpayer before we get to the point of enforced collections. So in a really high level, that's kind of our audit, filing enforcement, and collection processes. That is that component of that 3%. And it's obviously more expensive for us to do that than it is to do the voluntary compliance component. So we really try to shift people from what you see here on that red category into the blue category, because the long-term effectiveness of our system is really dependent on that. Mm-hmm.
That's a great summary. Let me just add for Representative Whitsitt that we do have several compliance bills that we'll be looking at, and in the process of looking at those, I'm sure we'll get into more detail on how the department deals with enforcement, because it's all part of compliance. Mm-hmm. But I think that's a great, quick 3-minute overview.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Which is a great lead into the next slide, on slide six, about our compliance continuum. As you can see, the arrows there, one side is red and one side is blue. And we spend about half of the resources that you allocate to us on voluntary compliance and the other half on enforced compliance. So as you can see, we really strive to get these people from the red category into the blue category, because it's easier, it's cheaper, it's more effective for us to get them in that category for the long-term health of the system. Okay.
Thank you. I think one of the points that you didn't make is that when your enforcement works correctly, you move people out of the enforcement area into future compliance over the next several years or longer. So there's not, it doesn't look like there's a huge amount of money in that little red sliver, but it represents a much larger amount of money from people who now are believers and actually file their returns and pay their taxes. Please, go ahead.
I was wondering how you determine your database for who should be paying taxes, because obviously we have a huge underground, in all states have it, mm-hmm. but we've got a huge underground of either workers or mm-hmm. goods that taxes are not paid on. And so it seems like once you're in the system, you can be followed along. But what about all of the people out there that are not paying taxes because they're not part of the system? I mean, I know this sounds really strange, but you know, maybe we should be using the driver's license database that we've got for tax collection purposes or enforcement purposes. I mean, there's your group of people, and it's just an idea because right. Go ahead and answer.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, we have what we call that component that you're talking about is what is most states call discovery, and where we're trying to discover people that are not in our system now, and that goes to our filing enforcement process for wage earners and for self-employed people. And we use databases now. Currently, we have access to DMV information for determining residency. That's one of the factors we look at to see if they are required to file a return here in Oregon. We use employment department information from the payroll tax returns to see if they have wages. And we have several other sources of information to determine whether they are out there in the world making money that should be taxed and currently is off the radar. We also have a group of compliance specialists in our business, in our payroll tax program, that looks for people who are working underground. They go out into the field and they look for businesses, and then they look in our system to say, look, is this little store here, storefront, in our system? And if not, they initiate contact with them and say, look, these are your obligations. And we work in close partnership with the Secretary of State's office and our partners at Department of Employment and DCBS to make sure these businesses understand their obligations when it comes to employee reporting. So we have a pretty fleshed out discovery process now, understand that there's that gap component that we just can't ever really get to, and so. That is where we're trying to get to it with that. And we do use quite a few resources to get there.
Mm-hmm. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't resist the temptation, Representative Whitsitt, since you brought up the DMV. I was horrified to discover a few years ago that DMV system runs on COBOL, which I subsequently learned is a computer language invented during World War II. Mm-hmm. So we have some work to do on their systems as well, I think.
Yeah, and of course, you're asking the questions that the committee has asked many times in connection with compliance issues. Some of those questions will come up again later in some of the bills that we're dealing with, but I think a couple of us were smiling while you were asking the question because not because they're not valid questions, they're absolutely valid questions, but because we're reminded of the debates that we've already had on these topics.
Right.
Very willing to have them again because, of course, all of us, I think, want that people who owe taxes actually pay them. And that's what this discussion's about. Please
Mr.
go ahead.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. And we do appreciate the opportunity to come and educate you about what we do as an agency because it is complex and there's a lot of working parts in making this happen. So so moving on to slide 7 of your presentation, we'll talk about our cigarette and tobacco tax programs. I know they aren't an income tax, but they are a big part of what we do, and you do as a committee deal with a lot of the work that on these particular taxes. And you'll see that there's about, on your slide, $512 million that comes in from the cigarette and other tobacco taxes, from the tobacco taxes. And most of them, as you can see, about $319 million goes to Oregon Health Plan. They're dedicated to different funds. $23 million goes to mental health programs, $22 million to cities, counties, and public transit. $16 million to smoking cessation programs, and then the rest of it, about a quarter of it, goes into your general fund. The cigarette administration is different than our income tax programs in that, as you heard in our discussion of House Bill 2489, we issue stamps to indicate that the tax has been paid on the product. And we sell those stamps to wholesalers and distributors who then affix the stamps to the packets. They actually do take them, open the boxes, the cartons, and stamp every single one of them. So you'll see very quickly that those stamps, that the tax has been paid because the product is stamped. We have an enforcement piece here as well. We have compliance specialists that go out and do inspections of different different businesses to look to see if they have cigarette stamps or cigarettes. And if they do, we check to see if the stamp is there and that there are invoices that match that. So we do have an enforcement piece there. So it is a pretty efficient process by the sale of the stamps. It's very different than our other programs. The other tobacco tax program is more like the income tax programs in that the taxpayer has to file a return with us and tell us what their tax is. Wholesalers report the amount of tobacco that they introduce into the state by filing that return. Then they pay a tax based on the weight of that product, and then we audit those returns as they arise, very much like our income tax program. So we work through that same process there to make sure that the correct amount of tax has been paid. We also have agreements with 8 of the tribes to sell untaxed cigarettes to their tribal members. So what they do is they actually, selling untaxed cigarettes creates an enforcement problem for us, and the tax doesn't apply to them. So they've agreed voluntarily to go ahead and sell the taxed product, and then we rebate to them the amount of taxed product that has been sold to their tribal members. It's very efficient and way for us to deal with it, so we don't have to worry and try and figure out who has gone on the reservation and who hasn't properly purchased the cigarettes. So their members do not have to pay the tax, and so we do rebate that to them. It's much easier for us to administer the tax that way, and they've been really great to work with on getting those out there. We negotiated similarly for our other tobacco tax programs, which are, you know, the little cans of snuff and moist snuff and chew and other things like that, I believe. And with the see if I can remember the name correctly, the Confederated Tribes of the Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siusla tribes, what we hope to be a model for other tobacco that's very, very similar. So we hope to use that for negotiating agreements with other tribes so we can have the same similarities in administration.
The question again.
Yes, yes, Representative. What's it?
Just catching up. So, is there a federal law that says that tribal members don't have to pay cigarette tax? Yeah. Or,
yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, that's exactly right. They're sovereign nations, and it's almost like a, I don't know how, for lack of a better way of explaining this, it's like their own state. Yeah. They're inside our state, so they have their own rules. So we work closely with them, and we really appreciate the relationship we have with them. Mm-hmm.
So when you see a smoke shop, a tribal smoke shop, anybody can go into it, but do they check a card then that says they're a member and then they don't pay the tax, or, and then if somebody else comes in, doesn't have a card, they pay the tax?
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, I don't know the exact process, but I believe that is correct. Yeah.
Yeah, that's Representative Leininger.
So I've been thinking about marijuana tax levying lately, and it's interesting to me I guess I'm realizing, so the Department of Revenue handles cigarette tobacco tax, but it doesn't handle alcohol tax.
That's right.
And how is that? Is it unusual for a state to have taxing authority divided between among several agencies? I know with some other states do their marijuana taxation through the Department of Revenue, but they may not have an analogous OLCC. If you could speak to that just for a couple of minutes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leininger, I believe that those other states also are sales tax states, and so other states do separate their taxation administration depending on, even for example, unemployment taxes are administered by one agency, income taxes are administered by another agency, so it's not unusual in the state level for that to happen. The beer and wine and the liquor taxes that are administered by OLCC, I think those are, I think people call them, they're kind of a quasi-state sales tax, and that is, I think, the same way they're handling the marijuana in Measure 91, and that's, if that helps answer your question.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I think you just helped identify an issue that's interesting to think about, so thank you.
I think it's partly historical, too, because the OLCC, of course, came into existence with the end of Prohibition, and a bunch of states actually did set up state agencies to manage alcohol at that time that way, and hard liquor doesn't have a tax. We use a markup on hard liquor. We tax beer and wine, and so that might be an interesting topic, Paul, for for us to have a brief overview at some point, just to get an idea of how this all came about the way it is in Oregon. Because a lot of it is historical accident as to how these things develop. And of course, in the case of the marijuana law that you're supposed to be evaluating, that was actually written into the initiative, as you know.
Right.
Yeah. Anything else on that? Representative Vega Peterson.
This is kind of a follow-up comment to Representative Leininger's. But I think that some of the other states, the Department of Revenue in those states may also handle the sales tax pieces, where since we don't have the sales tax,
right,
we don't have a mechanism. Because we ran into this with the 911 issue last session, where it was, you know, we had to figure out a way to handle this, because we don't do sales tax, and the department doesn't do that as part of its, you know, part of its normal duties.
Where did that, may I ask you, Paul, where did that end up being housed? In the Department of Revenue or someplace else?
Mr. Chair, if you'd like me to, I can.
Yep. Give us the short version.
Yeah, I'll give you the short version. I'll try to. Representative Leininger, the bill that Representative Vega Peterson is referring to was, it was changing the way that the tax was collected,
right,
from bills, monthly statements, you know, from, and it dealt with people who purchase cell phones and prepaid. And so it's a 75-cent tax that's collected monthly on your bill. But there was an issue about how you collect it on people who have prepaid cell phones.
Right.
And so
right,
they wanted to have it moved to the tax being collected at the cash register, which is a point of sale system, which is similar to sales tax.
Right.
So they did move to that last session, and they will be implementing that in this next fall in our,
right,
and part of it is because we have a core system replacement. We have a new system coming in, and so we were able to tie it in with some of the rollout schedule of that program to be able to actually do a point of sale tax.
So you are administering it, but it's just a
we
a bunch
are
of
administering
new
it.
Okay,
it's just
thanks.
A little bit.
And we'll hear more about the core system replacement next week. Next week, mm-hmm, and I assume they'll give us a little squib on that piece.
Yes, because that is in this next rollout.
Yeah.
So, Mr. Chair,
please, if
you'd like me to go on. So, going on to slide 8, it just goes on to tell you some of the other programs that we administer. We have several, and of course, we mentioned 911. We do administer that. Of course, this is just illustrates the breadth of information that we deal with. Of course, I don't have property tax listed here, but that is a huge component of what we do, and we have a whole division dealing with that, but sorry about that omission. And if you have any other questions, I'm happy to answer what I can.
Representative Whitsitt. And then over here, yes.
Yeah, if you, for example, on the Stop Smoking Education, $16 million, do you ever follow up and see what they're doing with that money? And make sure that that's what they're doing with it. I mean, I kind of hear rumors that most of that money isn't actually going for what was intended, and I don't know how you would figure that out. Do you then say, what are you doing with that money?
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, we don't have that oversight authority. I believe that is another agency. I could find out for sure what that agency is. We just distribute the money. The money comes in, and we distribute it to the agency that's responsible for that oversight.
Do you find out?
I want to say Oregon Health Authority, but I'll find out for sure.
Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I might have missed it in your presentation, but what's the current level of state tax on a pack of cigarettes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, the current level, I believe, is $1.31 after the 13-cent increase that just happened in last January.
And you're getting a head nod from Paul, so he agrees.
Mike, he's a perfect.
Follow-up would be,
please,
how do we compare with other states?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I think that might be something that Paul would have. I know that we do have some information. I want to say we're middle of the road, and maybe he can confirm on that number. But
get back to us with that.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
Yes, and of course, as we look at some of the bills that we have, we'll definitely get into the details of that.
Here it comes.
Of that, and it looks like Paul's about to give you a list, which you may learn more than you want to know on that topic. Representative Smith Warder.
So if I can go back to slide 3, which showed the pie chart of the general fund, and compare it to slide 8, the 4% of other revenues Are those contained within these the programs on 8, or where, you know, I guess could you tell a little bit more about what is part of that other, that 4%?
The other. The other is some of those other programs that are on that slide 8. Yes, that is correct.
Okay. And are there more that aren't on this list?
Gosh, I believe there are, like the Royal Rail Car, some really obscure programs that we manage.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Vance?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And looking at that pie chart of the net general fund revenues, the state tax number is $189 million. My understanding is that's a little higher than normal. Do we have a normal number for estate tax?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vince, I don't know what that normal number is, but I agree. I believe that is higher than it has been. I do. I'm fairly certain on that, but I can get you that information.
Follow up.
Please, yeah.
I saw a bill that would equalize our estate tax to the federal government's estate tax. It'd be interesting to see how much that number would diminish if we were to do that.
I think that, Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I can work with LRO staff to get that estimate to you.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, what equalized means is in the eye of the beholder. Yeah, I think. You're probably referring to the exempt amount, that kind of thing?
I am.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you for that, Mr. Chair.
Well, you're usually so precise, and you all of a sudden you weren't. So
I should have added... if we match the exemption, thank you.
There it is.
Right? No, it's not. This just gives us the total number. We'd have to have the amount that's in excess of the federal exemption, which is $5.5 million per person, I think.
These days, right?
Yeah.
That's right.
And it's moving.
And
that's
Mr.
Right.
Chair, Representative Benz, we're still at the $1 million, right? I believe.
Yes,
we're
at the $1 million.
So yeah,
yes.
To bring it to what the federal exemption is.
Right. What's that space?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, right.
I understood.
Right. Right. We had an amendment. We had a bill in which we considered all of those issues, and one of the amendments would have established the exempt amount to be the same as the federal government, but it would have raised the rate in order to equalize the dollars that coming in. That did not pass, and we stayed with the first part of the proposal, which was $1 million, which I think was an increase over what we were before, wasn't it? Yeah. So. I mean, that's a useful issue for us to discuss again, but it's beyond the scope of this particular presentation. Anything else on this presentation today? I really appreciate the committee's questions very much, because in some ways it's a reprise of things we've already done, but it's also an indication that one of the things this committee does is that we continue to review the same things over and over again in order to try to do better, in order to try to improve both our laws and the operation of the department and other things, because, of course, without the good work of the department, there would be no general fund and there would be no budget. So it's critically important that we get that done. If there's nothing else, thank you very much. We very much appreciate the presentation today. Committee, we'll close the information hearing, and unless there's further business, we'll see you tomorrow. We are adjourned.